WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, Stephen Van Zandt, the guitarist for Bruce Springsteen's E Street Band and the actor who plays hitman Silvio Dante on The Sopranos. He's made it his personal mission to revive interest in garage band rock on his syndicated radio show and this weekend with the Little Stevens International Underground Garage Festival. Also, we remember world-renowned chef Julia Child. She died yesterday at the age of 91. And TV critic David Bianculli previews coverage of the Olympics and considers some TV shows you might want to watch as an alternative. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Hurricane Charley swept ashore in Port Charlotte, Florida this afternoon. Its winds of 145 miles per hour make it a Category 4 storm, stronger than many forecasters had expected. More than a million people have been urged to leave their homes in west central Florida and seek shelter inland. Rick Cotton is the manager of a 7-Eleven in Port Charlotte. He's amazed at those who haven't done that yet.
I can't believe that there's idiots out there on the highway right now. I really feel for their safety. I think the best place to be is inside someplace safe and secure.
Governor Jeb Bush said the damage could exceed $15 billion. President George Bush has declared the region a federal disaster area. Forecasters are expecting that Charley will bring more dangerous storms to the Carolinas this weekend. Tornadoes touched down today in eastern North Carolina, remnants of Tropical Storm Bonnie. Three people were killed. From member station WUNC, David Brower reports.
Those who died this morning were trapped inside their mobile home when the storm hit. The tornado that touched down a few hours before daybreak was one of at least five reported overnight. Jeff Orrock from the National Weather Service says storms like this often catch people off guard.
These are very fast. These aren't your classic, you know, tornadoes like you see in Oklahoma or Kansas where, you know, you see these things coming a mile away. These things come in instantaneously, and they're usually embedded in heavy rain, so you very rarely may even see it. It may just be real rainy outside. Wind starts blowing real hard. Next thing you know, the tornado's on your house.
Orrick says it's likely more tornadoes will hit the southeast over the next couple of days as Hurricane Charley heads inland. For NPR News, I'm David Brower in Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
President Bush and Senator John Kerry both campaigned in Oregon today. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
Kerry met with about 100 residents outside the home of a school teacher and firefighter on a quiet cul-de-sac where every driveway has a basketball hoop. Kerry used the opportunity to blast President Bush's tax cuts. He cited a new Congressional Budget Office study that found the share of taxes paid by wealthy Americans fell, while the share paid by middle-class workers increased.
We're living in the biggest shift of income from the average working person to the wealthiest people, and you're paying more.
From Springfield, Kerry travels to Portland, Oregon, where he'll wrap up a two-week cross-country campaign trip. Scott Horsley, NPR News, with the Kerry campaign, Springfield, Oregon.
President Bush held a town meeting in Beaverton, where he said some small businesses have benefited from his tax cuts.
When you reduce individual income taxes for S-corps and sole proprietorships, you're really saying we're going to stimulate the small business sector of America. And it's paying off. I'm telling you, it's paying off.
The Dow gained 10 points to close at 98.25. The Nasdaq rose 4 points to close at 17.57. This is NPR News. The nation's trade deficit hit an all-time high in June, reaching nearly $56 billion. NPR's Luke Burbank reports.
Essentially, a trade deficit means a country is importing more goods than it's exporting. And according to the Commerce Department, the U.S. trade deficit jumped by over $10 billion between May and June of this year to an all-time high of nearly $56 billion. Greg Anderson, an analyst at ABN AMRO in Chicago, was shocked at the size of that increase. He says there is some reason for concern.
It's a long-term structural problem, but the key is it's a long-term structural problem that we thought at least wasn't getting any worse, and now all of a sudden it looks like it is.
Although a trade deficit means more manufacturing jobs outside the U.S., a negative sign for American workers, it also shows the U.S. has the capital to spend on importing goods, which is generally considered a positive sign. Luke Burbank, NPR News, Washington.
In another government report out today, the Labor Department said its producer price index rose 0.1% last month. That figure measures prices at the wholesale level. Energy prices had jumped 2.3%, but they were offset by a drop in food costs of 1.6%. The family of Julia Child says the grand dame of cooking shows died early this morning in her sleep at her home in California. She was 91. Her public television show, The French Chef, was a hit on public TV as she introduced many Americans to the fine art of French cooking. But fellow French chef and longtime friend Jacques Pepin said the Child was not a snob when it came to food. That should go to the store and buy Wonder Bread and iceberg lettuce. I'm Noor Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Nissan and Nissan Genuine Service and Parts, helping keep Nissans ready for the road ahead. Dealer locator information available at nissanusa.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, in for Terry Gross. Stephen Van Zandt is a man of many talents. He co-stars in The Sopranos as Silvio Dante, the hitman and owner of the Bada Bing strip club. Van Zandt is also the guitarist in Bruce Springsteen's band. Like Springsteen, he's from New Jersey, and that's where they met in the 70s. In the mid-80s, he left Springsteen's E Street Band to pursue a solo career. Although he returned to Springsteen's band, he continues to make solo albums. Van Zandt is also the host of a syndicated radio program called Little Steven's Underground Garage.
You are back, baby, on the front lines of the rock and roll revolution. Let them go on about how rock is dead. If you were listening to the other radio stations in town, you'd think rock is dead too. That's why you got to keep it right here, 24 hours a day. Don't even hit the buttons anymore. Break all them buttons off. This is the coolest radio station in town. You know why? Because we are on here. That's why. We're here to swing, baby.
And the Hard Rock. Apparently, radio, TV, and guitar playing aren't enough for Van Zandt. Tomorrow, he'll put on Little Steven's International Underground Garage Festival at Randall's Island in New York. Iggy Pop and the Stooges, the Strokes, the Pete Best Band, Bo Diddley, and a slew of other bands will be performing. So what is garage rock? When he was on Fresh Air in 2002, he told Terry he could best define it with this 1966 recording by Van Morrison's first band, Them.
Stephen Van Zandt, welcome to Fresh Air. Why did you want to do your own radio show?
I miss those days when the DJ would turn you on to new things, and you could develop a relationship with that DJ and a relationship with that station. And that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to it's not all unfamiliar, but quite a bit of what I do is turning people on to hopefully new things. So it's fun.
So give us a sense of what fits under your definition of garage rock.
Well, and let's be very clear that this is my definition, because
right,
you know,
yeah.
I don't want to be accused of, you know, trying to be, you know, there's nothing.
You don't
really
want Lenny Kaye calling up and complaining.
Well, he'll just walk over and kick my butt. But this is nothing. There's nothing academic. You know, this should not be mistaken to be anything having to do with historically accurate or you know. Anyway, for me, the garage situation, the entire garage scene, really is based around the British Invasion and of 64. Everything before that, I believe, led directly to the British invasion, and the British invasion has influenced everything that has come since. It's literally the classic British invasion of the early Beatles, Rolling Stones, Who, Kinks, Yardbirds, Animals, Hollies. I also play a lot of the 60s pop music, such as Paul Revere and the Raiders, the Turtles, Dave Clark Five, that kind of thing. Then there's the classic garage nugget stuff, a lot of the one-hit type of groups of Electric Prunes, Music Machine. I then move into the 70s with the New York Dolls and the Ramones and that kind of stuff. And then into the first and second generations of the modern garage movement, which started in the 80s. And then the new stuff right now, Shazam, Greenhorns, Creatures of the Golden Dawn, and I'm playing quite a few new things as well. So,
my guest is Steven Van Zandt, and he now has a Sunday night radio program called Little Steven's Underground Garage, in which he plays garage rock. Let's listen to a track from your most recent CD called Born Again Savage, and this is a track that I think we'll surely hear the influence of the kind of bands that you're playing now. This is Guns, Drugs, and Gasoline. You want to say anything about it?
Well, it's not exactly garage rock. It was specifically made to be a 60s hard rock record, which is the era just after garage, circa 69 or so it would have been. But yeah, everything I do comes from the garage bands, obviously. But this is not classic garage. This is in the hard rock world, actually.
Okay. This is Steven Van Zandt.
I know. You need a scorecard, right? I know.
So this is Guns, Drugs, and Gasoline. My guest is Steven Van Zandt of The Sopranos, of the Bruce Springsteen Band, and of his own radio show, Little Steven's Underground Garage. The track that we just heard is from his latest CD, which is called Born Again Savage. What was the first band that you ever had?
My own first band was a band called The Source, 1966. We were one of the first bands to break the mold. In those days, you had to play the top 40. And my band was one of the first to play FM radio rock type of album cuts, you know. I was playing songs by The Who and Buffalo Springfield and Youngbloods and people like that, which was a bit strange back then. There wasn't too many of us. There wasn't too many bands back then, actually. It was a very different world. It was not a viable way to make a living yet, so you were considered really one step above a criminal, you know, being in a rock and roll band.
Who'd you play for?
Very, very, very lucky. My generation was the only generation, I think, that was really catered to that way. We had dozens and dozens of places to play. High schools, obviously. We had the beach clubs because we were on the Jersey Shore. VFW halls. There was a television show called Hullabaloo, which had Hullabaloo clubs. There was three of those clubs in New Jersey where we played. There was teenage nightclubs built specifically for teenagers, a place called Le Teen Des Vous. you know, just a lot of places, right? Especially before In that magical sort of period there from 65 to about 67, 68, before drugs really made it to the suburbs. And when once drugs came to the suburbs, all the teenage places got closed down. But, there was a very strange period of time. I don't think it's happened before or since where teenagers had so many cool places to go. You know? I don't know what they do now.
What was your band called then?
Oh, we had a different band every week. I mean, certainly every month. I mean, I had the Sundance Blues Band. I had one week I'd be in Bruce's band, and next week he'd be in my band, and I can't even think of all the names we had in those days. Steel Mill was one of the bands we had. We had, I forget, but, you know. Some of them never even got names. They broke up before we couldn't get a job. It was hard to get work. You know?
Did you meet Springsteen in Asbury Park because of this club?
No, we actually were on that same. It was a circuit that went from where I grew up was called Middletown, which was close to the Jersey Shore. He was in Freehold, which was further west, and then Asbury Park was to the south. And there was a hullabaloo club in all three of those towns. and so it became like a triangle. It was like a circuit. And we met in that circuit 65, 66, somewhere in there.
Gee, did these hullabaloo clubs have dancers in cages like on the TV shows?
No, I wish. No. Good idea, though.
Stephen Van Zandt speaking with Terry Gross in 2002. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Sleep there. Old Man Blues is going to try to find you everywhere.
Don't look back.
Well, you better not look.
Don't
now.
Look back.
Or he'll catch you.
Don't look back.
You gotta keep running.
Let's get back to Terry's interview with Stephen Van Zandt. Little Stephen's International Underground Garage Festival takes place tomorrow on Randall's Island in New York.
So when you first started playing with Springsteen, were you doing mostly covers or were you doing original songs?
No, I think by then we were pretty much doing all original songs. You know, our early bands in the 65, 66, 67 period were mostly cover bands, you know, but we did odd covers. His band did odd covers, so did mine. We were the first of a new generation of bands that were growing up with rock music as a given. You know, it was no longer pop music. It was no longer show business, exactly. The art form of rock started in 65. And that whole, you know, that whole sort of sensibility of rock music being a means of personal expression and all that. Was, you know, a fact by the time we pretty much came into our own. So,
How did life change for you in around, I guess it was 1975, when you were playing with Springsteen and the band really hit?
Well, it didn't change right away. The first thing that happened was I took a huge pay cut because we were very, very. I had a band called Southside Johnny and the Asbury Jukes, which
right.
We were playing at that point three nights a week. In Asbury Park and making quite a bit of money, and we were very successful. And just got kind of bored with it all, the bar wars, as I call it, and had the opportunity to, you know, Bruce was wanting to put the guitar down, and he had a couple of gigs booked. So, you know, he said, come on out. Let's, you know, get out of town for a minute. And he was really coming to the end of his... His career was pretty much over already at that point. He had like, you know, seven weeks of shows booked or something like that. So, you know, I went for 7 weeks and stayed 7 years. But at that point, it was not a, you know, the time a Newsweek thing hit as we were on doing those shows and got a second life. But things were not, it was a struggle.
So when did it start catching on commercially?
1980 with The River, with the fifth album.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had by then probably had a million people that we would play to. You know, we broke live rather than on the radio, which was unusual. That was really an invention of Frank Barcelona, who was our agent up until recently. Frank just recently sold Premier. Premier was the agency that was the first rock and roll agency ever. Frank Barcelona is quite a character. Anyway, he invented the concept of breaking an act by playing live. There was no such thing before him. And so we followed that philosophy for a number of years and, in fact, did break that way. We didn't need radio to succeed.
That really relies a lot on word of mouth, doesn't it?
It's word of mouth. It's going back to a city 3 and 4 times in a year,
mm-hmm.
you know, which is you could do in those days. You know, everybody gets in the station wagon and goes, you know.
Do you have a favorite of the early recordings you made with Springsteen?
Well, I guess The River will, you know, always have a place in my heart. It was the first record I produced, so it was a very meaningful record to me personally. But I think as far as a collection of songs, I think probably Darkness, Sunny Edge of Town probably has the best collection of songs. I don't know. You know, there's something interesting on every record, really.
Do you want to choose a track to play, Mr. DJ?
Play Fade Away from The River.
Okay, here it comes.
Now you say you found another man who does things to you that I can't. And that no matter what I do, it's all over now between me and you, girl. Well, I can't believe what you say. No, I can't believe what you say. Cause baby,
that's Bruce Springsteen, Fade Away from The River. My guest is guitarist, songwriter, and singer Stephen Van Zandt, who played with Springsteen for many years. Still played together, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We just got back together after
good
a short hiatus of 18 years.
And Stephen Van Zandt is also in The Sopranos, and now he has his own radio show in which he plays garage rock, and that's on Sunday nights. It's a syndicated show. Now, one of the things about the Springsteen band is that on stage there's always a lot of, like, male bonding action, you know. Springsteen and Clarence Clemens, or you and Springsteen looking at each other, and there's this, you know, this is kind of like bonding going on on stage. Is that something that you kind of planned out before, or is that just, like, chemistry that happens on stage?
No, we have a few weeks of bonding sessions before a tour.
Bonding rehearsals.
We go into the woods and sort of, you know, beat drums and bond. No, I think that's the band thing. You know, I mean, we're as close to a band as you can be, even though it's a solo artist, being Bruce Springsteen. And that's part of the band phenomenon, is that communication of friendship and family and, you know, the artificial family that McLuhan talked about, you know. But it's just it's the phenomenon that got started by the Beatles and the thing that everybody responded to. That new thing. It was a new concept, the concept of a band, you know.
Can you describe the feeling of being on stage in a stadium when the crowd is really, like, with you and is incredibly energized and the energy's all focused on stage, on you?
Well, you get there gradually, so the feeling doesn't change that much, you know what I mean? You get the same feeling from a club when you first start, you know, if that 200 people in a club are with you, that feels great. You know, I mean, there's an energy exchange going on that's really quite remarkable. And you carry that to theaters, and you carry that to arenas, and you carry it to stadiums. So, I mean, you don't sort of start in stadiums where I think it would be quite a shock to the system, you know. By the time you get there, you kind of have built your audience, you know. I mean, we built our audience one person at a time, you know. I don't know if you can do that anymore, but I think that's why there's fewer bands playing arenas and stadiums, because it's harder to. The infrastructure isn't really there anymore for rock and roll. But anyway, it's exactly as much fun as it looks like, you know, which is quite a bit.
How does performing in your 50s compare with performing in your 20s?
Well, you know, it's a lot more fun.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Why is it?
Because you don't care anymore. You know, you don't care about anything, particularly. You know, you just, there's not a lot of anxieties. You're not struggling, you know. You're not really trying to prove anything. You are who you are, and you better be pretty much at ease with that by now, or you are a mess. You know, it's mostly good stuff. You know what I mean? I mean, there's a lot of, when you're starting out, there's just a lot of, you know, you're struggling. You don't know whether you're going to make it or not. You don't know quite where you're going. Are you doing the right thing? Or all those, you know, thousands of questions you have as a kid. You know, at this point, you know, they've all pretty much been answered, you know. And as far as we're concerned, I don't know if this is true for everybody, but I mean, I'm able to go on stage with the same attitude as I've always, you know, since I was 15, which is, you know, I fully intend to do the greatest show anyone's ever seen. And I don't even consider anything less than that, you know. I think we all sort of feel that way.
Stephen Van Zandt speaking to Terry Gross in 2002. He hosts the weekly syndicated radio show Little Stephen's Underground Garage, and he plays hitman and Tony Soprano's consigliere Silvio Dante on The Sopranos. We'll hear more about that role in the second part of our show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
If you are just tuning in, you missed 17 of the coolest rock and roll songs ever recorded. Because that's our format here. You are in the Underground Garage, and in spite of all evidence to the contrary, I am Little Steven. We're on a Hard Rock Cafe pirate radio ship.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the German Information Center, celebrating the Day of German Unity on October 3rd. GIC on the web at www.germany.info/unity. And by Gotham Books, publishers of Almost French by Sarah Turnbull, based on the true story of one woman who finds adventure and the love of her life in Paris. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Stephen Van Zandt on his role as hitman Silvio Dante on The Sopranos. Also, David Biancooley previews TV coverage of the Olympics. And we remember MasterChef Julia Child. She died yesterday at the age of 91.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Stephen Van Zandt. He plays guitar in Bruce Springsteen's E Street Band, and he hosts his own weekly radio show, Little Stephen's Underground Garage. He also plays mobster Silvio Dante on The Sopranos, hitman consigliere, and owner of the Bada Bing strip club. Let's hear him in a scene. Tony Soprano is trying to break up with his Russian girlfriend, and he sends Silvio to give her the message that it's over.
How you doing, hon?
Who sent it, you, Tony?
Yeah, he asked me to bring you this.
What is that, money? I don't want it.
Yes, you do. There's $75,000 in here.
75?
Listen, Irina, I know you're upset. Let me give you a little advice. In my business, I see girls come and go. So I know time is the great enemy. You got a very short window. It's not good to get too hung up on any one thing. On the other hand, something new always comes along. I've seen it a million times. It's called The Passages. You know, it's a book.
Tell us the story of how you got the part of, how you got a part on The Sopranos.
Well, they wanted an Oscar winner. You know, they did not want to start small. So between me and Pacino and De Niro, and,
right.
You know.
Go with a winner.
They went with the best. You know, David Chase wanted to.
Is this creator of The Sopranos?
Sorry, yes, it's his vision, the whole thing. And he wanted to do something different. He'd been on TV a long time. I think he was quite bored with it all and wanted to do one last sort of something to offend as many people as he could and exact the revenge for which he longed for. I don't know, but he definitely wanted to do something different and wanted to have new faces, and he wanted to film it in New Jersey. Everybody in Hollywood laughed at him, of course. And
so how was your character created?
Well, didn't really exist. I guess I was one of the last ones to be cast, and we talked about what to do. I had a treatment, which I'd written years ago, about a character named Silvio Dante, who was a club owner of a Copacabana type of club, a big band type of club. In modern day, though, he was a guy who did not relate to the modern world, modern culture. So he had a 40s type of club, a 40s type of attitude. And he was an independent contractor. He was not a member of a mob family, but he was a hitman and really a retired hitman. And, all the action took place in this club. You know, sort of a bit of Casablanca in a way. Anyway, I had this guy and I told David about him and we talked about it and eventually, you know, the Copacabana idea was really beyond the budget, so it became a strip club and Silvio Dante was born.
So had you gone to many clubs like the Bada Bing? Did you know what the atmosphere was like?
No,
what the kind of dancing was like?
No. I've seen specials occasionally on television, but no, I wouldn't know personally firsthand anything about that. No, I'm a very good actor.
Well, one way or another, did you end up having to like go to clubs like that just to get a sense of?
For research?
Yeah.
I forced myself to do a bit of research, in the interest of. Maintaining that acting sort of suffering and,
Your character wears this kind of tall hair piece.
Are you suggesting that's not my real hair?
Yeah, right.
is that what you're suggesting?
Like, that's a big surprise, yeah. So whose idea was it to have... Like who designed, who gave the hairpiece the look? Who came up with the idea that you'd wear one and that it would have that kind of like thick, high, rug-like kind of quality to it.
Well, once the, you know, David and I agreed that the character was going to be the sort of throwback to the past, philosophically, you know, then he also should reflect that physically. So, you know, I wanted to make sort of a 50s-looking guy, you know, a guy who never really left the 50s, and that was it, you know. In other words, he's not particularly concerned with fat being fashionable or being taking part in the modern world at all, you know. So that was it. Once we decided that, the rest was easy. You know, went and found a special tailor, my boy Joe Camellia, who in the past had done some clothes for various characters. Let's leave it at that. And, you know, made sure the clothes were right and, you know, the look was right. And, you know, that made it a lot easier for me because I really am a outside-in sort of actor. You know, I mean, I need to look in the mirror and see the guy, you know.
Well, it's not like you've had a lot of theater training.
No, and I've had none. And so it was very helpful to me to be able to see a different guy in the mirror, you know.
So what was it like the first time you saw that guy in the mirror?
Well, I became, you know, it was just very, very, very easy to become him. And I had done a very detailed sort of biography of the character, so I really had a good understanding of him and, you know, discussed that with the writers so that everybody was more or less on the same page. Then, you know, then, of course, the writers take you where they want to take you. But, you know, there was a pretty good understanding of who the guy is to begin with, certainly in my head. And, you know, unfortunately, part of who he was fearless, so when I walked onto the stage, the fact that I was acting for the first time didn't worry me at all because I was this other guy, you know. And he does not scare easily, you know.
What about your voice?
Well, I wanted to be as different as I could be, you know, in every way, you know. Voice, facial expression, I gained probably 40, 50 pounds. You know, just I wanted to be absolutely unrecognizable, which is why it was such a shock when 2 weeks after the show was on, you know, half the people in the street were coming up to me saying they really love The Sopranos. I'm like, how the hell do you recognize me? You know? I mean, I look so different.
Now, if you wrote a biography of your character, you must know what music he likes.
Oh yeah, no, he's absolutely a 40s and 50s guy. I mean, no compromise whatsoever. He's not into rock and roll at all. You know, he's Tony Bennett, he's, you know, Dean Martin, Sinatra, and Johnny Roselli, and, you know, that gang.
Stephen Van Zandt speaking with Terry Gross in 2002. He plays Silvio Dante, Soprano family hitman and advisor to Tony Soprano. Let's hear a scene from this season's final episode. A difficult and dangerous situation has been brewing in the Soprano crime family, and Tony has refused to confront it. Sil thinks it's time to deal with it.
I gotta talk to you, Tony.
About what?
Tony, look, I've been your consigliere for a lot of years.
Don't go into a f***ing preamble. Just tell me what's on your mind.
You got some unhappy people out there. Not just the young guys. Talking about guys that have been with you since the beginning. Since before the beginning. Guys who worked for your father.
F***ing Paulie, right?
Nah, I'm not saying nothing.
Yeah, well, damn him.
These guys, Tom, will do whatever you order.
Except in this case.
Don't say it like that.
Forget that Tony Blodetto's my cousin. I give him up, we can give the whole f***ing dig up.
Here's where the conversation gets difficult.
Go.
All due respect. You were ready to hand him your cousin a week ago. So it's not about standing with the guys or upholding some rules. Not really.
Then what's it all about? Why don't you illuminate me?
It's about you don't want to eat shit from John. You don't want to bow down. You told him to go f*** himself. Which, to be honest, wasn't exactly appropriate, considering.
Oh, is that right?
All due respect.
What the f*** do you know what goes on in my head?
I've known you since you were a kid, Tom. Frankly, you got a problem with authority.
We'll hear more of Terry's interview with Stephen Van Zandt in a moment. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Stephen Van Zandt, who plays mobster Silvio Dante on The Sopranos.
Now, in The Sopranos, you wear that hairpiece. In your own performances, you wear a bandana on your head. How did you start doing that?
It was one of those things that early on I was I had some. It was a car accident where I got damaged a bit, and my hair never really grew in properly from that moment on. And I wasn't sure which way to go with it, you know. So I just started wearing the bandana rather than getting into the wig thing. It just didn't feel right at the time. And it just sort of stuck, you know, sort of became my thing, accidentally, really. So it paid off nicely, actually, in the end, because now you really can, I mean, if some other characters come along, if some of the movie parts or whatever ever came along, which they may or may not, I can very easily be somebody very, very different just from changing the hair, you know.
Right.
Which I like. You know, I really do like that aspect of it, you know, being a different person physically.
Do you wear the bandana when you're not on stage?
Oh, yeah, all the time, yeah.
And yeah. Still for that same reason, because of the accent?
It's just me, yeah, it's just, it's messed up. I mean, my actual head is a bit messed up still. It always will be.
Like scars, or?
Yeah, some of that. And just, you know, it never quite grew in. So it's just, you know, not a pretty thing.
When you were creating your character, and even now that your character is, you know, has been around for a few years, did you feel like you should be observing wise guys where you could, so that you would be creating a character based on real life and not just based on movies? Or did you think the thing to do was to look at all the movies and base it on movies, which is what The Sopranos is?
Well, yeah, it's interesting because it ended up being a bit of both, but I think the thing to keep in mind at this point is I think modern-day, you know, mob guys are very, very aware of the movies, which we talk about in the scripts, you know. That's a fact. I mean, a lot of the Godfather in particular was something that is well-known now, well-documented as teaching many mob guys how to be mob guys in a way. So, you know, it's a postmodern consciousness going on here where you're very aware of, you know, the movies that are, even though it's fictional in our case, the fictional characters are themselves watching the movies. So I think watching the movies was part of it. I went back and watched them all. Which I was a fan of anyway, and I knew them all pretty much by heart anyway. But I went back to whatever, Public Enemy and, you know, Scarface and those things, and reread all the books and all that. But as far as real life, I mean, I grew up in New Jersey in bars, you know, and they were there. I mean, whether they were the real thing or wannabes, you know, what's the difference? You know, you know, you're never going to really know. But they were there, so I saw what they really looked like and acted like. And, you know, and still to this day, of course, you would run into that type of guy.
Well, Stephen Van Zandt, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure, Terry.
And good luck with your radio show.
Thank you. You too.
Thanks.
Stephen Van Zandt speaking with Terry Gross in 2002. He plays mobster Silvio Dante on The Sopranos, plays guitar in Bruce Springsteen's E Street Band, and hosts a weekly syndicated radio program called Little Stephen's Underground Garage. Little Stephen's International Underground Garage Festival takes place tomorrow on Randall's Island in New York. The Summer Olympic Games begin officially tonight in Athens, with NBC presenting primetime coverage of the opening ceremonies. For the next 17 days, NBC will spread more than 1,200 hours of programming over NBC and its co-owned cable and satellite networks. Even so, TV critic David Beard Cooley says he doesn't have Olympic fever.
Atop the Acropolis, overlooking Athens, sits the Parthenon, Temple of Athena, Greek goddess of war, wisdom, and the arts. And it is with experience and artistry that the women of Team USA engage in their battle today. Athena, no doubt, would approve. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to our studios in Athens, and welcome to our coverage of the 2004 Olympic Games. I'm Jim Lampley, coming to you.
That was Wednesday afternoon on MSNBC. 2 days before the Olympics were supposed to start, and Jim Lampley already was serving up features and hosting games. The best thing about that particular game, in which the U.S. women's soccer team trounced Greece easily, was that it was presented by Hummer without commercial interruption. Yesterday, when the men's soccer team from Portugal faced the team from Iraq, yes, Iraq, it was a much closer and more interesting game. It also was interrupted several times by commercials, probably because the United States athletes weren't involved. By the way, Iraq won. The beauty of NBC's Olympic telecast this time is supposed to be its ability to bring fans more coverage than ever before of their favorite sport, no matter how obscure that sport may be. NBC is doing this because it's using its co-owned cable stations to present most of the competition, especially the live portions. Because Greece is 7 hours ahead of the U.S. on the East Coast, NBC's primetime coverage will be, for the most part, packaged from events taped earlier, the same way the network covered the games from Sydney 4 years ago. So if you want to see Michael Phelps, the most hyped athlete of this Olympics, swim in pursuit of one of his 8 gold medals, you'll have to watch NBC, and you won't see most of his events live. But if you have cable, you can watch judo and sailing tomorrow at midnight on Bravo. You can watch rowing and fencing all day tomorrow on CNBC. And you can watch boxing tomorrow afternoon on MSNBC and soccer tomorrow afternoon on Telemundo. Part of this approach I really support. Table tennis and volleyball? Bring it on. After all, I'm the guy who, not too many Winter Olympics ago, turned his giant C-band satellite dish to Canada's CBC just so I could watch live coverage of women's curling. And I loved it. But if you don't have cable, you're missing a lot. And what we all care and remember about the Olympic Games over the years are the shared experiences. As when all of America, it seems, watched Nadia Comaneci become the first female Olympic gymnast to earn a perfect 10. If you see a great judo match one midnight on Bravo, good luck finding someone at the water cooler the next day to share your enthusiasm. So NBC's primetime coverage remains the main event of this 17-day competition, and there are plenty of outside forces coming into play. Politically, things are so tense internationally that having the United States dominate the Olympic Games may be seen as simple bullying, especially if some of the athletes react with more attitude than grace. There's always the awful shadow of terrorism, which will hang over, but hopefully not intrude upon, these games. There are many scandals of doping and of failing drug tests, and of combinations of injury and apathy that have kept many U.S. athletes from competing this year. And then, last but unfortunately most, there's the hype. Instead of letting us discover the athletes and the drama for ourselves, the media are laying everything out in advance, down to how many medals Phelps could, should, and probably will win. What I look for most in coverage of Olympic Games, and expect to find less and less, is an appreciation of the accomplishment and pride of athletes from around the world. If someone from another country wins, I want to see their flag fly, listen to an unfamiliar national anthem, and watch them absorb and enjoy the moment. And I want to see that on NBC in primetime, not on Telemundo or Bravo. Each time, though, the Olympics as televised here seem to become more jingoistic, and my enthusiasm for the Olympics gets a little less feverish. So if you're not caught up in these games from Greece, and most other broadcast networks are throwing in the towel for the duration, what's a viewer to do? Here are some fast suggestions of 5 first-run shows offered right now on cable that you ought to be watching anyway. There's Entourage on HBO, a new comedy show about a rising young Hollywood star and his small gang of hangers-on. Also on HBO, there's 6 Feet Under, which has gotten really dark and strange this season, but continues to feature some really good acting. Both of those shows run on Sunday nights. Then, on FX, there are original episodes of the drama series Nip Tuck on Tuesdays, and a new show, Rescue Me, on Wednesdays. That one stars Dennis Leary as a New York firefighter who's dealing, in a post-9/11 world, with the loss of his friends and colleagues, as well as his marriage. It's a very intense show at times, but it's also unexpectedly hilarious. That's 4 shows. I promised 5. The last one, I guess, is a guilty pleasure, and it just ended last night, though the final installment will be repeated this weekend and next week several times, including tonight on Bravo. When Bravo isn't showing Olympic table tennis, that is. The Bravo series to which I'm referring is Celebrity Poker Showdown, in which comics, actors, and other celebrities play No Limit Texas Hold'em for charity. For some reason, I love this show. In fact, I think I have celebrity poker fever. And I only have to watch 1 channel, not 7, to feed it.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Coming up, we remember Master Chef Julia Child, who died yesterday at the age of 91. This is Fresh Air. Julia Child, who introduced millions of Americans to French cooking, has died at the age of 91 at her home in Santa Barbara, California. Julia Child's 1961 book, Mastering the Art of French Cooking, helped launch her on a public television career that lasted nearly 4 decades. Her longtime editor, Judith Jones, said Child changed the way cookbooks are written, aiming them at home cooks rather than professional chefs. Terry spoke with Julia Child in 1989.
Julia Child, when you co-wrote Mastering the Art of French Cooking, did you see it as a way to introduce Americans to French cuisine?
Yes, I was tremendously interested in French cuisine because it's the only cuisine that has the real rules on how to cook. And I wanted, because I had started in quite late. I was about in my early 30s when I started cooking. And I found that the recipes in all the books I had were really not adequate. They didn't tell you enough. And I won't do anything unless I'm told why I'm doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt that we needed fuller explanations so that if you followed one of those recipes, it should turn out exactly right. And that's why the recipes are very long, but they have full detail. And my feeling is that once you know everything and have digested it, then it becomes part of you.
You became nationally famous in the United States for your cooking show. I read that your cooking show started because you were a guest on someone else's show when your book Mastering the Art of French Cooking
mm-hmm.
came out, and there was such a big response that they gave you your own show. At that time
when they did a book review. And I had to do something. You can't just talk about it. So I beat up some egg whites in a big copper bowl, that kind of thing that people have not seen before, and I made an omelet. And at that time, there were no cooking shows at all on television. And people said, well, why don't we have a cooking show? And so I did three pilots, and they got a lot of response because there weren't any on at that point, and French cooking was very much in vogue. And at that time, also, public television was mostly talking heads. And they wanted to have something that was a little more lively. And so that's how it really started in.
Were your early shows live?
No, nothing was live, but the early shows, because we were very, very, very strict budget, it was really live on tape.
Mm-hmm.
And so once we started in, we didn't stop at all, unless there was a terrible disaster, and we only had about two or three, I think.
Tell me one of the terrible disasters.
Well, one time I was blanching some broccoli, and it was in a salad basket, which was lowered into a big kettle, and when I picked it up, my fork slipped, and it all fell on the floor. I didn't pick it up and use it, so we did stop, because it was a real mess. But every time we stopped, it would cost, several hundred dollars, because it always took half an hour to get back again. And you have to pay overtime. And another time there was a short circuit on my microphone, and every time I touched the stove, the microphone would go and I'd clutch my breast. So we had to stop for that. But otherwise, we just didn't stop at all. And then people would say, well, I saw you drop that chicken on the floor, which, of course, I never did. All I did was flip a potato pancake into the stove. And then I put it back into the pan, and I said, well, if you're all alone in the kitchen, nobody will know. It's funny that people saw me do that to a chicken. Isn't that funny how people will say that?
So were there often mistakes in the actual show that you would recover from, thinking that, well,
yes,
this kind of thing happens all the time to real cooks?
And I think some people would accuse me of doing things purposely, but anyone who's been in the kitchen knows that awful things happen all the time, and you just... If you're a cook, you have to make do with whatever happens.
Julia Child speaking with Terry Gross. Child died yesterday at her home in Santa Barbara, California. She was 91. You can find audio and video of Child discussing her permanent kitchen display at the Smithsonian at npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Gotham Books, publishers of Almost French by Sarah Turnbull, based on the true story of one woman who finds adventure and the love of her life in Paris. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with James Bennett, who's just completed his assignment as Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the New York Times. His story, A Nation Unto Himself, Where is Ariel Sharon Leading Israel, is on the cover of this Sunday's New York Times Magazine. I'm Dave Davies. Join us for the next Fresh Air.